Welcome back to another great episode of Without a Trace. Hopefully you guys have been enjoying the other episodes, because if you are, that's great. You know, this past week we've done a lot, and obviously we do a lot for the simple fact just to get the content out there to you guys. Thank you for your support with every episode that has been coming out and that will be coming. If you haven't followed us for any updates and you want to know what we're doing, whether it's behind the scenes, upcoming series, no delays, or even just the whole football field pretty much, then make sure that you follow us on Facebook, After Dark Coast to Coast Killers. Once again, our Facebook page is After Dark Coast to Coast Killers. And if you haven't been notified, and you want to be notified, make sure that you're following us. If you are, then make sure that you're notified. If you aren't notified, simple. You just make sure that you swipe the tab bar to the right, and it will tell you that you are going to be notified. Today's episode is about the Yuba County Five. Four of these men were found dead. The other has not been found yet. I'm going to just issue a viewer's discretion advice, even though I don't really have to on this episode, because we are going to be talking about death. Let's get right into this episode. If you don't know where Yuba City is, it's in California. And all the people that are part of this case has had mild intellectual disabilities or psychiatric conditions. All of them also attended a college basketball game at California State University on the night of February 24th of 1978. The four people that were found dead was Bill Sterling, Jack Hewitt, Ted Ware, and Jack Madruga. All of them pretty much were young people ranging from early 20s to early 30s. Even the missing person, which is Gary Mathias, he was 25. Several days after their initial disappearance, the group's Mercury Montego was found. It was abandoned, and it was in a remote area of Plumas National Forest, on a high mountain dirt road that was far out of their way back to Yuba City. When investigators, such as say, found the car, they couldn't determine why it was abandoned, because it was in good working order and could have easily been pushed out of the snowpack that it was in. At the time, before the four men were found dead, they could not be found. There was no trace of them. In June of 1978, after the snow melted, four of the men's bodies were found in and near a trailer camp used by backpackers as shelter deep in the forest, 20 miles from the car. Three of the bodies only had bones left, a result of scavenging animals, but the one in the trailer, which was Ted's, had apparently lived for as long as 3 months after the men were last seen. Starving to death, he had pretty much had, you know, just a small amount of food and heating materials nearby. One of them was missing his shoes, and investigators found Matthias' own shoes in the nearby woods, suggesting that Matthias also survived for some time beyond the last night they were seen alive. A local man was a witness that later came forward, who said he had spent the same night in his own car a short distance away from where the Montego was found after suffering a mild heart attack trying to push it out of the snow. The witness told police that he had seen and heard people around the car that night, and twice called for help, only for them to go silent and turn off their flashlights. This and the considerable distance from the car to where the bodies were found has led to suspicions of foul play. Now we're going to talk about Matthias and who Matthias is, because this is the guy, once again, that has gone missing. Matthias was stationed in West Germany as part of his United States Army service in the early 1970s. He is an, or I should say, was a native of Yuba City, California. Eventually, he had developed drug problems as well. He did at some point become diagnosed with schizophrenia and being psychiatrically discharged from the army because of it. Matthias returned to his parents' home in Yuba City and then began treatment at the local mental hospital. While it had been difficult for him at first, he was nearly arrested for assault twice and often suffered psychotic episodes that landed him in a local Veterans Administration hospital. By 1978, he was being treated at an outpatient basis with Stilazine and Congagen. Sorry if I mispronounced that medication, but without further ado, and it was considered by his doctors to be one of their sterling success cases. Matthias supplemented his army disability pay by working in his stepfather's gardening business. When he wasn't working outside of the family, he was close friends with four other men, most likely older than him, and also had slight intellectual disabilities. This was Sterling Hewitt. And they were also considered salt learners, as such of Ware and Madruga, which was also an army veteran. And these guys pretty much lived within approximate range, whether within Yuba City or nearby Marysville. Like Matthias, each of these men lived with his parents, and they referred to them collectively as the boys. The five men's favorite leisure activity was sports. Their family said that they got together and it was usually to play a game or to watch one. In their free time when they were playing together, they also played basketball at the Gateway Gators, a team sponsored by a local program that sponsored mentally handicapped people. On February 25th, the Gators were due to play the first game in a week-long tournament sponsored by the Special Olympics, for which the winners would get a free week in Los Angeles. The five men had prepared the night before, some even laying out their uniforms and asking parents to wake them up on time. They decided to drive to Chico a night to cheer on the UC Davis basketball team in an away game against Chico State. Madruga, the only member of the group besides Matthias who had a driver's license, drove the group 50 miles north to Chico in his turquoise and white 1969 Mercury Montego. The men wore only light coats against the cool temperatures in the upper Sacramento Valley at the time of night due to the year. Now, before we continue, you know, we kind of got a, you know, what really happened to these men. What really happened the night of their disappearance? You know, I got, you know, two theories. I hate to point one of these men at the rest, but if it's even slightly possible to why they just were the way they are. In some cases, it could have been that, you know, Matthias did something because of schizophrenia, or due to, you know, the situation that they were laying out and found in, it could suggest that they were just lost, I guess. I know that's a bad way of saying things, but they were. They once again had disabilities that affected them all. And in attempts like these, whether or not it was due to attempts at the time, I think it's possible to say the four men If it's not the other theory, they just died. Not due to lack of food or, accessories, but lack of heat. Now let's talk about the disappearance. After the Davis team won the game, the group got back into the car and drove short distance from the Chico State campus to Bears Market in downtown Chico. They brought snacks along with sodas and cartons of milk to drink. It was shortly before the store's 10 p.m. closing time. The clerk later remembered the men because she was annoyed that such a large group had come in and delayed her from beginning the process of closing the store for the night. After that, none of the men were seen alive again. Their homes, they never returned to. The parents stayed up to make sure that they did. When morning had come, the police were notified. People asked the question of why did it take adult cases to go and turn into a missing persons case? There's a lot of reasons for this. In this case, the reason that the police were notified and they made a case out of it was because these men had disabilities. If it was a person that, didn't really have any mental disabilities and in a situation of what's being called a normal human being or normal person, police will just say, they're an adult, they're fine, they're probably out with a friend, running late, something like that. That's the difference of how fast police are to respond to certain adult cases. When the investigation started, police in Butte and Yuba counties began searching along the route the men took to Chico. They found no sign of them, but a few days later, a Plumas National Forest ranger told investigators that he had seen the Montego parked along Oroville Quincy Road on February 25th. At the time, he had not considered it significant since many residents often drove up that road into the Sierra Nevada on winter weekends to go cross-country skiing from the extensive trail system. But after he read the missing person bulletin, he recognized the car and then led the deputies to it on the 28th of February. When the car was discovered, it was abandoned, and the evidence that suggests that the men inside was because the wrappers and empty cartons and cans they had purchased in Chico were still present, along with programs from the basketball game they had watched and a neatly folded map of California. But the discovery of the abandoned car had raised questions, and I guess it still kind of does to this day. So let's talk about the location from Chico. First was this location that made it odd. 70 miles from Chico, far off of any direct route to Yuba City or Marysville. None of the men's families could speculate as to why they might have driven up a long and winding dirt road on a winter night deep into a high elevation remote forest without any extra clothing, and on the night before a basketball game they had been talking excitedly about among themselves for several weeks. Madraga's parents said he did not like the cold weather and had never been in the mountains. Sterling's father had once taken his son to the area near where the car was found for a fishing weekend, but the younger man had not enjoyed it and remained home when his father took later trips there. This part tells us a lot. It describes why they would have taken the road. And when I state that, we don't know why, but why they would have just taken this road, when they didn't really want to be there, and even one of them never has been there, never liked the cold. You gotta remember, this is a mountain during the winter season. It snows and snows and snows so much in these mountains, no matter where you go. I'm not going to speculate anything, but it seems like even with their own map, like I said, these men had intellectual disabilities. We don't know who was holding their old map. We know that it was dark. I can't say that they used a light in the car or a flashlight, but if it was possible, they took this road because they may have gotten lost. And it was familiar to a couple of the people. Police could not figure out why, once again, men had abandoned the car. They had reached 4,400 feet in elevation along the road, about where the snow line was at the time of the year, just short of where the road was closed for the winter. The car had become stuck in snow drifts, and there was evidence that the wheels had been spun attempting to get out of it. But police noted that the snow was not so deep that five healthy young men would not have been able to push it out. They also noticed that the keys were not present in the car, suggesting at first that the car had been abandoned because it might not have been functioning properly, with the intention of returning later with help. But when police hotwired the car, the engine started immediately. The fuel gauge indicated that the tank was one quarter full. As the mystery deepened, the police towed the car back to the station and they gave it a more thorough examination. The Montagu's undercarriage had no dents, gouges, or even mud scrapes, not even on its low-hanging muffler. Despite having been driven long distance up a mountain road with many bumps and ruts, either the driver had been extremely careful or it was someone familiar with the road, a familiarity Madruga was not known to have. Nor, his family said, would Madruga have let someone else drive the car. The car was unlocked and had a window down when it was found. His family indicated it was unlike him to leave his car so unsecured. This also kind of gives us a little bit more. We got these odd details that Madraga wouldn't do. And let's just speculate on the idea of maybe Madraga was getting tired, and once again, we know that one person knows this road. Whether or not he remembered the road, he may have been familiar with this road and wanted to take a scenic tour. Enjoy the celebration of the basketball team winning and beating Chico. And like I said, that's all speculation. Now, why certain things were with the car? For example, there was no damage and the car's window was unrolled, raises a lot more questions. Efforts to search the vicinity were hampered by a severe snowstorm that day. 2 days later, after searches of snowcats nearly became lost themselves, further search efforts were called off due to continuing bad weather. No trace of the men was found other than the car at the time. And we're going to talk about some sightings, along this February night or so. So, as of every missing case, there was media local or media coverage, and the police received several reports of some or all of the men being sighted after they had left Chico, including reports of them being seen elsewhere in California or in the country. Most of these reports were easily dismissed, but the two of the sightings stood out. According to a guy named Joseph of Sacramento, he told police he inadvertently wound up staying the night of February 24th to 25th near where the Montego was found. He had driven up there where he had a cabin to check the snowpack in advance of a weekend six trip or of a weekend ski trip, not six, sorry about that, with his family. At 5:30 p.m., about 150 feet of the road, he too had gotten stuck in the snow. He tried freeing his car. he realized he was beginning to experience early symptoms of a heart attack after, continuously pushing. So he went back in and he provided heat himself because he let the engine continue running. 6 hours later, lying in the car and experienced severe pain, he saw headlights coming up behind him. Looking out, he saw a car parked behind him, headlights on, with a group of people in it, or around it at least, to be more specific. One of which seemed to him to be a woman holding a baby. He called to them for help, but then they stopped talking and turned their headlights out. Later he saw more lights from behind him, this time flashlights, that also went out when he called to them. After that, he at first recalled a pickup truck parking 20 feet behind him briefly, and then continuing on down the road. He clarified later to the police that he could not be sure of that since at the time he was almost delirious from the pain he was in. After his car ran out of gas in the early morning hours, his pain subsided enough for him to walk 8 miles down the road to a lodge, where the manager drove him back, passing the abandoned Montego, the point where he recalled hearing the voices that they were originating from. Doctors later confirmed that he indeed experienced a mild heart attack. Ware's mother, I should say, said ignoring someone's pleas for help was not like her son, if indeed he had been present. She recalled how he and Sterling had helped someone they knew to the hospital after overdosing on Valium. Now, it seemed like the mother is saying that her son knew how to get help, and this is just me once again theorizing on this half of it. Maybe the reason that if her son was present at the time of Joseph being there, he just didn't know Joseph. Sometimes people with even the smallest mental disabilities become afraid of asking for help from people that they don't know, because it's uncomfortable, they don't know the person, it's night time, even, all those other reasons. The other notable report was from a woman who worked at a store in the small town Brownsville, 30 miles from the point where the car had been abandoned, which they would have reached had they continued down the road from where the car had been found. On March 3rd, the woman who saw flyers that had been distributed with the men's pictures and information about the $1,215 in modern dollars, that's $4,800 or so, reward the families had put up, told deputies that four of them had stopped at the store in red pickup truck 2 days after the disappearance. The store owner corroborated her account. So it looks like this red pickup story does match up. Obviously who these people are or were, we don't know. The woman said she identified the men immediately as from out of the area due to their big eyes and facial expressions. Two of the men whom she identified as Huet and Sterling were in the telephone booth outside the store, while the other two went inside. Police said she was a credible witness and they took her account seriously. So it seemed like these men were driving a pickup truck. And like, I'm just going to state this. I don't know anything about this car, so I don't know what it looks like or anything. But now I know who was driving it. In short, let's just continue. Additional detail came from the store owner, who told investigators that men whom he believed to be Ware and Hewitt came in and bought burritos, chocolate milk, and soft drinks. Ware's brother told the LA Times that while driving to Brownsville in a different car, an apparent ignorance of the basketball game seemed completely out of character for them. The owner's description of the two men's behavior seemed consistent with them, as Ware would eat anything he could get his hands on and was often accompanied by Hewitt more than any of the four. However, Hewitt's brother said Jack hated using telephones to the point that he would answer calls for Jack whenever he received them from any from the other men in the group, I should say. So some things still stand out, you know, who was using the telephone, you know, who went aside, what the behavior is typically like. Maybe in certain cases, you know, in desperate cases, whatever the case is, maybe their behaviors change. You know, like I said, it's a desperate situation maybe, and they're just trying to call somebody, and whatever their phone call was, maybe it was just different because of the situation that they were in, and that, you know, maybe they weren't expecting to be back on time or whatnot. Who knows? And that's the other question. Who did these two men call and why? Eventually, the bodies were discovered after the evidence didn't point any clear conclusion about what happened to the five men that disappeared. Police and the families were not ruling out the possibility that they had met with foul play, but once the four bodies were discovered, it seemed to suggest otherwise. And then it even raised more questions about what happened that night, or whether at least one of them might have been rescued. On June 4th, with most of the higher elevation snow melted, a group of motorcyclists went to a trailer maintained by the Forest Service at a campsite off the road about 19.4 miles from where the Montego had been found. A front window of the trailer had been broken. When they opened the door, they were overcome by the odor of what turned out to be decaying body inside. It was later identified as Weyer's. Searchers returned to Plumas, following the road between the trailer and the site of the Montego. The next day, they found remains later identified as Mondraga and Sterling, on opposite sides of the road from where the car had been. Madraga's body had been partially consumed by scavenging animals, only bones remained of Starling, scattered over a small area. Autopsies showed that they had both died of hypothermia. Deputies also speculated that one may have succumbed to the desire for sleep that marks the condition's final stages, and the other refused to leave the site, eventually meeting the same fate. 2 days later, as part of one of the other search parties, Jack Hewitt's father found his son's backbone under a bush northeast of the trailer. His shoes and jeans nearby helped identify the body. The next day, a deputy sheriff found a skull downhill from the bush, confirmed by dental records later to have been Hewitt's. His death too has been attributed to hypothermia. In an area to the northwest of the trailer, roughly a quarter mile from it, searchers found three Forest Service blankets and a rusted flashlight by the road. It could not be determined how long those items had been there, since Matthias had presumably had not taken his medications. Pictures of him were distributed to mental institutions all over California. However, no trace of him has ever been found. Before we go on, I want you to listen to our sponsor. To the trailer, there was evidence in it. Weyer's body was on a bed with eight sheets around it, including the head. The autopsy showed that he died of a combination of starvation and hypothermia. Weyer had lost nearly half his 200 pounds, and the growth of his beard suggested that he had lived as long as 13 weeks from when he had last shaved. His feet were badly frostbitten, almost gangrenous. On a table next to the bed were some of Weyer's personal effects, including his wallet with cash, a nickel ring, and that had Ted engraved on it and a gold necklace he also wore. Also on the table was a gold watch without a crystal, which Weir's family said was not his, and a partially melted candle. He was wearing a velour shirt and lightweight pants, but his shoes could not be found. The most puzzling things to the investigators was how Weir had come to his fate. No fire had been set in the trailer's fireplace, despite an ample supply of matches and paperback novels to use as kindling. Heavy forestry clothing, which could have kept the man warm, also remained where it had been stored. A dozen sea ration cans from a storage shed outside had been opened and their contents consumed, but a locker in the same shed that held an even greater assortment of dehydrated foods, enough to keep all 5 men fed for a year, if that had been necessary, and none of these dehydrated foods had ever been opened. Similarly, another shed nearby held a butane tank with a valve that had been opened, would have fed the trailer's heating system. This behavior, however, was consistent with what Weir's family members described as a lack of common sense arising from his mental disability. He often questioned why he should stop at a stop sign, and one night he needed to be dragged out of bed while his bedroom ceiling was burning in a house fire, since he was worried about missing his job the next day if he left his bed. It also seemed that Weir had not been alone in the trailer, and that Matthias and possibly Hewitt had been there with him. Matthias's tennis sneakers were in the trailer, and the sea rations had been opened with a P-38 can opener, which only Matthias and Mandraga would have been familiar with from the military service. Matthias, his feet perhaps also swollen from frostbite, could have decided to put Weir's shoes on instead if he ventured outside. The sheets all over Weir's body also just suggested that one of the others had been there with him, as his gangrenous feet would have been in too much pain for him to pull them over his body himself. Now there's a theory or so out there. Even knowing that the 4 of the 5 men had died in the Sierra, investigators still could not completely explain what had led to those deaths. They still had food, no explanation for, or they still have found no explanation for, sorry, for why the men were there. Although they learned that Matthias had friends in the small town of Forgetown, and police believed it was possible an attempt to visit them on the way back home. The men may have turned a wrong way that put them on the mountain road. For whatever reason, these men left months ago. They had, instead of going back down the road where they had passed the lodge that Sean's later returned to, and once again that's Joseph, continued along the road in the direction they were originally going. Purposeful motion like that is not consistent with the circular patterns traveled by those who generally believe themselves lost. The day before the men went missing, a Forest Service snowcat had gone along the road in that direction to clear the snow off the trailer roof so that it would not collapse. It was possible that police believe that the group had decided to follow the tracks it left through 4 to 6 feet snow drifts high. For whatever reason, though, it is in the belief that shelter was not too far away. Madraga and Sterling probably succumbed to hypothermia once again and wait long walk to the trailer. It is assumed that once they found the trailer, the other three broke the window to enter, and since it was locked, they may have believed it was private property and may have feared arrest or theft if they used anything else they found there. After Weir died, or the others believed he had, they perhaps chose to attempt to return to civilization by different routes over land on foot. Now, these are somewhat interesting theories, I guess, and that's because it's simple, no? It's easy to believe that whatever happened there, and it's very possible, that these people did what they did, and they feared for being arrested, and that happens in people with mental disabilities. These type of people fear a lot. They fear that, if they do this, this will happen. If they interact with certain people, bad things are going to happen. And in the account from Joseph, this probably did what happened. And I'm not saying it actually did, but it has a high probability. They didn't know maybe who was calling them. Maybe they just seen a car running and didn't think of anything else. Maybe they feared that if they walked over to this guy that, he would hurt them. And so they decided to go off into the forest, eventually succumbing to their death. Now, I wish the question that re would remain is, what happened to Gary Mathias? Why was he the only one gone? And that has several theories in itself. We can say that Mathias, since him not taking his medication, may have gone crazy, started seeing things, maybe felt like he was being attacked by his friends. And another theory, maybe he wandered off because him being a army veteran, he thought that going this way would help him. And maybe with, because there was no map on them as they entered the forest. Map was still in the car. And with the forest being so dense, Matthias got lost and he never found help, which seemed very probable as well, for the simple fact, like I said, the only reason that Matthias was ever discharged from the military was due to his diagnosis of schizophrenia. So he, out of all of them, it seemed like he was the one that would get help. He probably told them, "Hey, I'm gonna get help." But then that also raises the question of why was Matthias's shoes found in the trailer? So maybe he didn't just want to get help. Maybe he had a schizophrenic episode and he ran out of the trailer and the episode alluded. Because sometimes people with schizophrenia, if it's a situation that can trigger their schizophrenia, they may be an episode for who knows how long. They may start seeing things. They may start experiencing things, hearing things. Then they go crazy sometimes. And when they go crazy, they do things that aren't them. No, those are the other theories. No, I wish it would conclude with, Matthias is still alive, but we don't know that. We don't know why his shoes was there. The other thing that stood out with me, I don't know about you guys, but was Weyer's body had eight sheets around it, and they were wrapped, including his head. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that the reason that his head was wrapped was the obvious reason, but it's kind of hard to wrap eight sheets and layer those eight sheets. by yourself, definitely around your head. And if that's true, maybe, well, let's say if it is possible. No, I don't know how many beds were in the trailer. I don't know what was all in the trailer. But let's say, in the worst case of supporting one of these theories that the police had said, the other men that were found outside of the trailer feared that they would be arrested and they slept outside. So, in the case of survival, maybe, Weyer just did what he could. Maybe these sheets were used previously and, or not, let's just say they weren't, and Weyer noticed that his friends had died. So he finally found the sheets, and I know it's a crazy theory like that, but anything's possible. You know, you may have your own theories about what happened, definitely if you're from Yuba City and that general area and have heard this case before. Everything is possible. You know, maybe it was a bear attack, which I know doesn't necessarily explain everything, but it could explain why Matthias disappeared without his shoes. Now let's go turn back onto Joseph. Let's say, for example, Joseph is a suspect instead of a witness. He noticed this red truck parked behind him, and it was an odd situation. You know, he also said that in this truck there was a woman and a baby. But according to this eyewitness account at, I think it was the gas station, the people occupying the truck was these four men. Think about that. Joseph said that there was a woman and a baby. Obviously, he did recant that account because of the heart attack. But let's just say, you know, he's a suspect. What did Joseph do? Where was Matthias? And let me just reread a little bit. See if Matthias actually came with them. Just reading quickly. It doesn't necessarily say besides Weyer and Hewitt. Let's see. Hewitt and Sterling were in a telephone booth outside the store, while the other two went in. Let's see. The store owner told investigators the men who he believed to be Weyer and Hewitt came in and brought burritos and all the other stuff. There's something not adding up here. I just don't know what it is yet. But there's only four men. Maybe Matthias stayed inside the pickup. But still, the account that Jack gave the police does not match up. And I'm going to reread that statement a little bit. According to police, Joseph said at first he recalled a pickup truck parking 20 feet behind him briefly and then continuing down the road. Later, he clarified to the police that he was not sure of it. And then as he was laying in his car, experiencing severe pain, that's when the pickup truck came behind him. He said that there was a group of people, and one of them seemed to be a woman holding a baby. Something just doesn't add up in between Joseph and, what was scary and all of this in between that time. And this the police has suspected it was foul play. Maybe it was Joseph. Maybe Matthias turned on them. Maybe they succumbed to each other and realized they fucked up. But whatever the possibility is, we don't know, and we really won't know. And let's say if Joseph was brought into questioning again, and the police became a polygraph, even question him. It's years since it happened. Statement can be changed over time because of lack of memory. So that's why polygraph couldn't work for Joseph. That's why questioning him, despite him confessing to it may not work. Obviously, maybe he would confess to it, and the police would, take that into consideration. But Joseph was the only other person there. But we can just dive into Joseph, but we're not going to because I don't have information about Joseph. But if you have your own theories, speculation, possibilities, you can just tell me on Facebook. Tell your friends, tell the police, I don't care. Tell whoever about your theories, your possibilities, and speculations. With that, we're going to conclude this episode of Without a Trace. See you next time on Without a Trace or whatever episode. Thank you for tuning in. Once again, follow us on Facebook and get notified on your podcast listening app. See you next time.